The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing on page 188, Chapter 7, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom. The knowledge on which the doer of works in yoga has to found all his action and development has for the keystone of its structure a more and more concrete perception of unity, the living sense of an all-pervading oneness. He moves in the increasing consciousness of all existence as an indivisible whole. All work, too, is part of this divine indivisible whole. His personal action and its results can no longer be or seem a separate movement mainly or entirely determined by the egoistic free will of an individual, himself separate in the mass. Our works are part of an indivisible cosmic action. They are put, or more accurately, put themselves into their place in the whole out of which they arise, and their outcome is determined by forces that overpass us. That world action in its vast totality and in every petty detail is the indivisible movement of the One who manifests himself progressively in the cosmos. Man, too, becomes progressively conscious of the truth of himself and the truth of things in proportion as he awakens to this One within him and outside him and to the occult, miraculous, and significant process of its forces in the motion of nature. This action, this movement, is not confined even in ourselves and those around us to the little fragmentary portion of the cosmic activities of which we, in our superficial consciousness, are aware. It is supported by an immense underlying environing existence subliminal to our minds or subconscious, and it is attracted by an immense transcending existence which is superconscious to our nature. Our action arises, as we ourselves have emerged, out of a universality of which we are not aware. We give it a shape by our personal temperament, personal mind and will of thought, or force of impulse, or desire. But the true truth of things, the true law of action, exceeds these personal and human formations. Every standpoint, every man-made rule of action which ignores the indivisible totality of the cosmic movement, whatever its utility in external practice, is, to the eye of spiritual truth, an imperfect view and a law of the ignorance. Even when we have arrived at some glimpse of this idea, or succeeded in fixing it in our consciousness as a knowledge of the mind and a consequent attitude of the soul, it is difficult for us in our outward parts and active nature to square accounts between this universal standpoint and the claims of our personal opinion, our personal will, our personal emotion and desire. We are forced still to go on dealing with this indivisible movement as if it were a mass of impersonal material out of which we, the ego, the person, have to carve something, according to our own will and mental fantasy, by a personal struggle and effort. This is man's normal attitude towards his environment, actually false, because our ego and its will are creations and puppets of the cosmic forces. And it is only when we withdraw from ego into the consciousness of the divine knowledge will of the eternal, who acts in them, that we can be, by a sort of deputation from above, their master. And yet, is this personal position the right attitude for man, so long as he cherishes his individuality and has not yet fully developed it? For without this viewpoint and motive force, he cannot grow in his ego, cannot sufficiently develop and differentiate himself out of the subconscious or half-conscious universal mass existence. But the hold of this ego consciousness upon our whole habit of existence is difficult to shake off when we have no longer need of the separative, the individualistic, and aggressive stage of development. When we would proceed forward from this necessity of littleness in the child soul to unity and universality, to the cosmic consciousness and beyond, to our transcendent spirit stature. It is indispensable to recognize clearly, not only in our mode of thought, but in our way of feeling, sensing, doing, that this movement, this universal action, is not a helpless impersonal wave of being which lends itself to the will of any ego according to that ego's strength and insistence. It is the movement of a cosmic being who is the knower of his field, the steps of a divinity who is the master of his own progressive force of action. As the movement is one and indivisible, so he who is present in the movement is one, soul, and indivisible. Not only all result is determined by him, but all initiation, action, and process are dependent on the motion of his cosmic force, and only belong secondarily and in their form to the creature. But what then must be the spiritual position of the personal worker? What is his true relation in dynamic nature to this one cosmic being and this one total movement? He is a center only, a center of differentiation of the one personal consciousness, a center of determination of the one total movement. His personality reflects in a wave of persistent individuality the one universal person, the transcendent, the eternal. In the ignorance, it is always a broken and distorted reflection because the crest of the wave, which is our conscious waking self, throws back only an imperfect and falsified similitude of the divine spirit. All our opinions, standards, formations, principles are only attempts to represent in this broken, reflecting, and distorting mirror something of the universal and progressive total action and its many-sided movement towards some ultimate self-revelation of the divine. Our mind represents it as best it can, with a narrow approximation that becomes less and less inadequate in proportion as its thought grows in wideness and light and power. But it is always an approximation and not even a true partial figure. The divine will acts through the eons to reveal progressively not only in the unity of the cosmos, not only in the collectivity of living and thinking creatures, but in the soul of each individual, something of its divine mystery and the hidden truth of the infinite. Therefore, there is in the cosmos, in the collectivity, in the individual, a rooted instinct or belief in its own perfectibility, a constant drive towards an ever-increasing and more adequate and more harmonious self-development nearer to the secret truth of things. This effort is represented to the constructing mind of man by standards of knowledge, feeling, character, aesthesis, and action. Rules, ideals, norms, and laws that he essays to turn into universal dharmas. If we are to be free in the spirit, if we are to be subject only to the Supreme Truth, we must discard the idea that our mental or moral laws are binding on the infinite, or that there can be anything sacrosanct, absolute, or eternal, even in the highest of our existing standards of conduct. To form higher and higher temporary standards, as long as they are needed, is to serve the divine in his world march. To erect rigidly an absolute standard is to attempt the erection of a barrier against the eternal waters in their onflow. Once the nature-bound soul realizes this truth, it is delivered from the duality of good and evil. For good is all that helps the individual and the world towards their divine fullness, and evil is all that retards or breaks up that increasing perfection. But since the perfection is progressive, evolutive in time, good and evil are also shifting quantities and change from time to time their meaning and value. This thing which is evil now and in its present shape must be abandoned, was once helpful and necessary to the general and individual progress. And that other thing which we now regard as evil may well become, in another form and arrangement, an element in some future perfection. And on the spiritual level, we transcend even this distinction, for we discover the purpose and divine utility of all these things that we call good and evil. Then have we to reject the falsehood in them, and all that is distorted, ignorant, and obscure in that which is called good, no less than in that which is called evil. For we have then to accept only the true and the divine, but to make no other distinction in the eternal processes. To those who can act only on a rigid standard, to those who can feel only the human and not the divine values, this truth may seem to be a dangerous concession, which is likely to destroy the very foundation of morality, confuse all conduct, and establish only chaos. Certainly, if the choice must be between an eternal and unchanging ethics and no ethics at all, it would have that result for man in his ignorance. But even on the human level, if we have light enough and flexibility enough to recognize that a standard of conduct may be temporary and yet necessary for its time, and to observe it faithfully until it can be replaced by a better, then we suffer no such loss, but lose only the fanaticism of an imperfect and intolerant virtue. In its place, we gain openness and a power of continual moral progression, charity, the capacity to enter into an understanding sympathy with all this world of struggling and stumbling creatures, and by that charity, a better right and a greater strength to help it upon its way. In the end, where the human closes and the divine commences, where the mental disappears into the supramental consciousness and the finite precipitates itself into the infinite, all evil disappears into a transcendent divine good, which becomes universal on every plane of consciousness that it touches. This, then, stands fixed for us, that all standards by which we may seek to govern our conduct are only our temporary, imperfect, and evolutive attempts to represent to ourselves our stumbling mental progress in the universal self-realization towards which nature moves. But the divine manifestation cannot be bound by our little rules and fragile sanctities, for the consciousness behind it is too vast for these things. Once we have grasped this fact, disconcerting enough to the absolutism of our reason, we shall better be able to put in their right place, in regard to each other, the successive standards that govern the different stages in the growth of the individual and the collective march of mankind. At the most general of them, we may cast a passing glance, for we have to see how they stand in relation to that other standardless spiritual and supramental mode of working for which yoga seeks, and to which it moves by the surrender of the individual to the divine will, and, more effectively, through his assent by this surrender to the greater consciousness in which a certain identity with the dynamic eternal becomes possible. Stopping at bottom of page 192.